There are many kinds of delusion. According to what you are here, ugly or beautiful, stupid or clever, you will become ugly or beautiful, stupid or clever lies.
What about me?
Atreyu asked.
What will I be?
Gamork grinned.
I won't tell you that. You'll see. Or rather, you won't see, because you won't be yourself anymore.
Atreyu stared at the werewolf with wide-open eyes. Gamork went on.
That's why humans hate Fantastica and everything that comes from here. They want to destroy it. And they don't realize that by trying to destroy it, they multiply the lies that keep flooding the human world. For these lies are nothing other than the creatures of Fantastica who have ceased to be themselves and survive only as living corpses, poisoning the souls of men with their fetid smell. But humans don't know it. Isn't that a good joke?
And there's no one left in the human world?
Atreyu asked in a whisper.
Who doesn't hate and fear us?
I know of none,
said Gamork.
And it's not surprising, because you yourselves, once you're there, can't help working to make humans believe that Fantastica doesn't exist.
Doesn't exist?
The bewildered Atreyu repeated.
That's right, sonny,
said Gamork.
In fact, that's the heart of the matter. Don't you see? If humans believe Fantastica doesn't exist, they won't get the idea of visiting your country. And as long as they don't know you creatures of Fantastica as you really are, the manipulators do what they like with them.
What can they do?
Whatever they please. When it comes to controlling human beings, there is no better instrument than lies. Because, you see, humans live by beliefs, and beliefs can be manipulated. The power to manipulate beliefs is the only thing that counts. That's why I sided with the powerful and served them, because I wanted to share their power.
I want no part in it,
Atreyu cried out.
Take it easy, you little fool,
the werewolf growled.
When your turn comes to jump into the nothing, you too will be a nameless servant of power with no will of your own. Who knows what use they will make of you? Maybe you'll help them persuade people to buy things they don't need, or hate things they know nothing about, or hold beliefs that make them easy to handle, or doubt the truths that might save them. Yes, you little Fantastican, big things will be done in the human world with your help. Wars started, empires founded.
For a time, Gamork peered at the boy out of half-closed eyes. Then he added,
the human world is full of weak-minded people who think they're as clever as can be and are convinced that it's terribly important to persuade even the children that Fantastica doesn't exist. Maybe they will be able to make good use of you.
Atreyu stood there with bowed head. Now he knew why humans had stopped coming to Fantastica and why none would come to give the childlike empress new names. The more of Fantastica that was destroyed, the more lies flooded the human world, and the more unlikely it became that a child of man should come to Fantastica. It was a vicious circle from which there was no escape. Now Atreyu knew it. And so did someone else. Bastian Balthazar Books. He now realized that not only was Fantastica sick, but the human world as well. The two were connected. He had always felt this, though he could not have explained why it was so. He had never been willing to believe that life had to be as grey and dull as people claimed. He heard them saying, life is like that. But he couldn't agree. He never stopped believing in mysteries and miracles. And now He knew that someone would have to go to Fantastica to make both worlds well again. If no human knew the way, it was precisely because of the lies and delusions that came into the world because Fantastica was being destroyed. It was these lies and delusions that made people blind. With horror and shame, Bastian thought of his own lies. He didn't count the stories he made up. That was something entirely different. But now and then, he had told deliberate lies, sometimes out of fear, sometimes as a way of getting something he wanted, sometimes just to puff himself up. What inhabitants of Fantastica might he have maimed and destroyed with his lies? One thing was plain. He, too, had contributed to the sad state of Fantastica. And he was determined to do something to make it well again. He owed it to Atreyu, who was prepared to make any sacrifice to bring Bastian to Fantastica. He had to find the way. The clock in the belfry struck 8. The werewolf had been watching Atreyu closely.
"Now you know how you can get to the human world," he said. "Do you still want to go, Sonny?"
Atreyu shook his head.
"I don't want to turn into a lie," he said.
"You'll do that whether you like it or not," said Gamork, almost cheerfully.
"But what about you? Why are you here?"
"I had a mission,"
Gamork said reluctantly.
"You too?"
Atreyu looked at the werewolf with interest, almost with sympathy.
"Were you successful?"
"No. If I had been, I wouldn't be lying here chained. Everything went pretty well until I came to this city. The Dark Princess who ruled here received me with every honor. She invited me to her palace, fed me royally, and did everything to make me think she was on my side. And naturally, the inhabitants of this land of ghosts rather appealed to me. They made me feel at home, so to speak. The Dark Princess was very beautiful in her way, to my taste at least. She stroked me and ran her fingers through my coat. No one had ever caressed me like that. In short, I lost my head and let my tongue get out of hand. She pretended to admire me. I lapped it up, and in the end I told her about my mission. She must have cast a spell on me, because I am ordinarily a light sleeper. When I woke up, I had this chain on me, and the Dark Princess was standing there. 'Gamork,' she said, 'you forgot that I too am one of the creatures of Fantastica. And that to fight against Fantastica is to fight against me. That makes you my enemy, and I've outsmarted you. This chain can never be undone by anyone but me. But I am going into the nothing with all my menservants and maidservants, and I shall never come back.' Then she turned on her heel and left me. But all the spooks didn't follow her example. It was only when the nothing came closer that more and more of them were unable to resist its attraction. If I'm not mistaken, the last of them have just gone. Yes, Sonny, I fell into a trap. I listened too long to that woman. But you have fallen into the same trap. You've listened too long to me. For in these moments, the nothing has closed around the city like a ring. You're caught, and there's no escape."
"Then we'll die together," said Atreyu.
"So we will," said Gamork, "but in very different ways, you little fool. For I shall die before the nothing gets here, but you will be swallowed up by it. There's a big difference. Because I die first, my story is at an end. But yours will go on forever, in the form of a lie.
Why are you so wicked? Atreyu asked.
Because you creatures had a world,
Gamork replied darkly,
and I didn't.
What was your mission?
Up until then, Gamork had been sitting up. Now he slumped to the ground. He was plainly at the end of his strength, and he spoke in raucous gasps.
Those whom I serve decided that Fantastica must be destroyed. But then they saw that their plan was endangered. They had learned that the childlike Empress had sent out a messenger, a great hero, and it looked as if he might succeed in bringing a human to Fantastica. They wanted to have him killed before it was too late. That was why they sent me, because I had been in Fantastica and knew my way around. I picked up his trail right away. I tracked him day and night, gradually coming closer. Through the land of the Sassafranians, the jungle temple of Mumawat, Howling Forest, the swamps of sadness, the dead mountains. But then, in the deep chasm by Igramul's net, I lost the track. He seemed to have dissolved into thin air. I went on searching. He had to be somewhere. But I never found his trail again. And this is where I ended up. I failed. But so has he. For Fantastica is going under. I forgot to tell you. His name was Atreyu.
Gamork raised his head. The boy had taken a step back.
I am Atreyu, he said.
A tremor ran through the werewolf's shrunken body. It came again and again and grew stronger and stronger. Then from his throat came a panting cough. It grew louder and more rasping. It swelled to a roar that echoed back from the city walls. The werewolf was laughing. It was the most horrible sound Atreyu had ever heard. Never again was he to hear anything like it. And then suddenly, it stopped. Gamork was dead. For a long time, Atreyu stood motionless. At length, he approached the dead werewolf. He himself didn't know why, bent over the head and touched the shaggy black fur. And in that moment, quicker than thought, Gamork's teeth snapped on Atreyu's leg. Even in death, the evil in him had lost none of its power. Desperately, Atreyu tried to break open the jaws. In vain. The gigantic teeth, as though held in place by steel clamps, dug into his flesh. Atreyu sank to the grimy pavement beside the werewolf's corpse, and step by step, soundless and irresistible, the nothing advanced from all sides through the high black wall surrounding the city. 10. The Flight to the Ivory Tower. Just as Atreyu passed through the somber gateway of Spook City and started on the exploration that was to end so dismally in a squalid backyard, Balcor, the Luck Dragon, was making an astonishing discovery. While searching tirelessly for his little friend and master, he had flown high into the clouds. On every side lay the sea, which was gradually growing calmer after the great storm that had churned it from top to bottom. Suddenly, far in the distance, Falcor caught sight of something that puzzled and intrigued him. It was as though a beam of golden light were going on and off, at regular intervals. And that beam of light seemed to point directly at him, Falcor. He flew toward it as fast as he could, and when he was directly over it, he saw that the light signal came from deep down in the water, perhaps from the bottom of the sea. Luck dragons, as we know, are creatures of air and fire. Not only is the liquid element alien to them, it is also their enemy. Water can extinguish them like a flame, or it can asphyxiate them. For they never stop breathing in air through their thousands of pearly scales. They feed on air and heat, and require no other nourishment. But without air and heat, they can only live a short time. Falcor didn't know what to do. He didn't even know what the strange blinking under the sea was, or whether it had anything to do with Atreyu. But he didn't hesitate for long. He flew high into the sky, turned around, and head down, pressing his legs close to his body, which he held stiff and straight as a telegraph pole. He plummeted. The water spouted like a fountain as he hit the sea at top speed. The shock was so great that he almost lost consciousness, but he forced himself to open his ruby-red eyes. By then, the blinking beam was close, only a few body lengths ahead of him. Air bubbles were forming around his body, as in a saucepan full of water just before it boils. He felt that he was cooling and weakening. With his last strength, he dived still deeper, and then the source of light was within reach. It was Orin, the gem. Luckily, the chain of the amulet had got caught on a coral branch growing out of the wall of an undersea chasm. Otherwise, the gem would have fallen into the bottomless depths. Falcor seized it and put the chain around his neck for fear of losing it, for he felt that he was about to faint. When he came to, he didn't know where he was, but to his amazement, he was flying through the air. And when he looked down, there was the sea again. He was flying in a very definite direction, and very fast, faster than would have seemed possible in his weakened condition. He tried to slow down, but soon found that his body would not obey him. An outside will, far stronger than his own, had taken possession of his body and was guiding it. That will came from Orin, the amulet suspended from a chain around his neck. The day was drawing to a close when at last Falcor sighted a beach in the distance. He couldn't see much of the country beyond. It seemed to be hidden by fog. But when he came closer, he saw that most of the land had been swallowed up by the nothing, which hurt his eyes and gave him the feeling of being blind. At that point, Falcor would probably have turned back if he had been able to do as he wanted. But the mysterious power of the gem forced him to fly straight ahead. And soon he knew why. For in the midst of the endless nothing, he discovered a small island that was still holding out, an island covered with high gabled houses and crooked towers. Falcor had a strong suspicion whom he would find there, and from then on it was not only the powerful will of the amulet that spurred him on, but his own as well. It was almost dark in the somber backyard where Atreyu lay beside the dead werewolf. The luck dragon was barely able to distinguish the boy's light-colored body from the monster's black coat, and the darker it grew, the more they looked like one body. Atreyu had long given up trying to break loose from the steel vise of the werewolf's jaws. Dazed with fear and weakness, he was back in the grass ocean. Before him stood the purple buffalo he had not killed. He called to the other children, his companions of the hunt, who by then had no doubt become real hunters. But no one answered. Only the giant buffalo stood there motionless, looking at him. Atreyu called Artax, his horse, but he didn't come, and his cheery neigh was nowhere to be heard. He called the childlike empress, but in vain. He wouldn't be able to tell her anything. He hadn't become a hunter, and he was no longer a messenger. He was a nobody. Atreyu had given up. But then he felt something else, a nothing. It must be very near, he thought. Again he felt its terrible force of attraction. It made him dizzy. He sat up and, groaning, tugged at his leg. But the fangs held fast. And in that he was lucky, for if Gamork's jaws had not held him, Falcor would have come too late. As it was, Atreyu suddenly heard the Luck Dragon's bronze voice in the sky above him.
"Atreyu! Are you there, Atreyu?"
"Falcor!"
Atreyu shouted. And then he cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted, "Falcor! Falcor, I'm here! Help me! I'm here!" And then he saw Falcor's white body darting like a living streak of lightning through the square of darkening sky, far away at first, then closer. Atreyu kept shouting, and Falcor answered in his bell-like voice. Then at last the dragon in the sky caught sight of the boy down below, no bigger than a bright speck in a dark hole. Falcor prepared for a landing, but the backyard was small. There was hardly any light left, and the dragon brushed against one of the high-gabled houses. The roof collapsed with a roar. Falcor felt an agonizing pain. The sharp edge of the roof had cut deep into his body. This wasn't one of his usual graceful landings. He came tumbling down on the grimy wet pavement next to Atreyu and the dead Gamork. He shook himself, sneezed like a dog coming out of the water, and said,
"At last! So this is where you are. Oh well, I seem to have got here on time."
Atreyu said nothing. He threw his arms around Falcor's neck and buried his face in the dragon's silvery white mane.
"Come," said Falcor, "climb on my back. We have no time to lose."
Atreyu only shook his head. And then Falcor saw that Atreyu's leg was imprisoned in the werewolf's jaws.
"Don't worry," he said, rolling his ruby-red eyeballs. "We'll fix that in a jiffy."
He set to with both paws, trying to pry Gamork's teeth apart. They didn't budge by a hairbreadth. Falcor heaved and panted. It was no use. Most likely he would never have set his young friend free if luck hadn't come to his help. But luck dragons, as we know, are lucky, and so are those they are fond of. When Falcor stopped to rest, he bent over Gamork's head to get a better look at it in the dark. And it so happened that the childlike empress's amulet, which was hanging from the chain on the dragon's neck, touched the werewolf's forehead. Instantly, the jaws opened, releasing Atreyu's leg.
"Hey!" cried Falcor. "What do you think of that?"
There was no answer from Atreyu.
"What's wrong?"
cried Falcor.
"Atreyu, where are you?"
He groped in the darkness for his friend. But Atreyu wasn't there. And while the dragon was trying to pierce the darkness with his glowing red eyes, he himself felt the pull that had snatched Atreyu away from him. The nothing was coming too close for comfort. But Orin protected the luck dragon from the pull. Atreyu was free from the werewolf's jaws, but not from the pull of the nothing. He tried to fight it, to kick, to push, but his limbs no longer obeyed him. A few feet more, and he would have been lost forever. In that moment, quick as lightning, Falcor grabbed him by his long blue-black hair and carried him up into the night-black sky. The clock in the belfry struck 9. Neither Atreyu nor Falcor could say later how long they had flown through the impenetrable darkness. Had it been only one night? Perhaps time had stopped for them, and they were hovering motionless in the limitless blackness. It was the longest night Atreyu had ever known, and the same was true for Falcor, who was much older. But even the longest and darkest of nights passes sooner or later, and when the pale dawn came, they glimpsed the ivory tower on the horizon. Here it seems necessary to pause for a moment and explain a special feature of Phantastican geography. Continents and oceans, mountains and watercourses have no fixed locations, as in the real world. Thus it would be quite impossible to draw a map of Phantastica. In Phantastica you can never be sure in advance what will be next to what. Even the directions, north, south, east and west, change from one part of the country to another, and the same goes for summer and winter, day and night. You can step out of a blazing hot desert straight into snowfields. In Fantastica, there are no measurable distances, so that near and far don't at all mean what they do in the real world. They vary with the traveller's wishes and state of mind. Since Fantastica has no boundaries, its centre can be anywhere. Or to put it another way, it is equally near to, or far from, anywhere. It all depends on who is trying to reach the centre. And the innermost centre of Fantastica is the Ivory Tower. To his surprise, Atreyu found himself sitting on the Luck Dragon's back. He couldn't remember how he had got there. All he remembered was that Falcor had pulled him up by the hair. Feeling cold, he gathered in his cloak, which was fluttering behind him. And then he saw that it was grey. It had lost its colour, and so had his skin and hair. And Falcor, as Atreyu discovered in the rising light, was no better off. The dragon looked unreal, more like a swath of grey mist than anything else. They had both come too close to the nothing.
"Atreyu, my little master," the dragon said softly, "does your wound hurt very badly?" About his own wound, he said nothing.
"No," said Atreyu, "I don't feel anything any more."
"Have you a fever?"
"No, Falcor, I don't think so. Why do you ask?"
"I can feel you trembling," said the dragon. "What in the world can make Atreyu tremble now?"
After a short silence, Atreyu said,
"We'll be there soon, and then I'll have to tell the childlike empress that nothing can save her. That's harder than anything else I've had to do."
"Yes," said Falcor, even more softly. "That's true."
They flew in silence, drawing steadily nearer to the ivory tower. After a while, the dragon spoke again.
"Have you seen her, Atreyu?"
"Who?"
"The childlike empress, or rather the golden-eyed commander of wishes, because that's how you must address her when you come into her presence."
"No, I've never seen her."
"I have. That was long ago. Your great-grandfather must have been a little boy at the time, and I was a young cloud-snapper with a head full of foolishness. One night I saw the moon shining so big and round, and I tried to grab it out of the sky. When I finally gave up, I dropped with exhaustion and landed near the ivory tower. That night the magnolia pavilion had opened its petals wide, and the childlike empress was sitting right in the middle of it. She cast a glance at me, just one short glance, but I hardly know how to put it. That glance made a new dragon of me."
"What does she look like?"
"Like a little girl. But she's much older than the oldest inhabitants of Fantastica. Or rather, she's ageless."
"Yes," said Atreyu. "But now she's deathly sick. How can I tell her that there's no hope?"
"Don't try to mislead her. She can't be fooled. Tell her the truth."
"But suppose it kills her?"
"I don't think it will work out that way," said Falcor.
"You wouldn't," said Atreyu, "because you're a luck dragon."
For a long while, nothing was said. When at last they spoke together for the third time, it was Atreyu who broke the silence.
"Falcor," he said, "I'd like to ask you one more thing."
"Fire away."
"Who is she?"
"What do you mean?"
"Orin has power over all the inhabitants of Fantastica, the creatures of both light and darkness. It also has power over you and me. And yet the childlike empress never exerts power. It's as if she weren't there. And yet she is in everything. Is she like us?"
"No," said Falcor. "She's not like us. She's not a creature of Fantastica. We all exist because she exists. But she's of a different kind."
Then, is she...
Atreyu hesitated.
Is she human?
No, said Falcor. She's not human.
Well then...
And Atreyu repeated his question.
Who is she?
After a long silence, Falcor answered, No one in Phantastica knows. No one can know. That's the deepest secret of our world. I once heard a wise man say that if anyone were to know the whole answer, he would cease to exist. I don't know what he meant. That's all I can tell you.
And now, said Atreyu, she'll die, and we'll die with her, and we'll never know her secret.
This time Falcor made no answer, but a smile played around the corners of his leonine mouth, as though to say, Nothing of the kind will happen. After that, they spoke no more. A little later, they flew over the outer edge of the labyrinth, the maze of flowerbeds, hedges, and winding paths that surrounded the ivory tower on all sides. To their horror, they saw that there too the nothing had been at work. True, it had touched only small spots in the labyrinth, but those spots were all about. The once bright-colored flowerbeds and shrubbery in between were now gray and withered. The branches of the once graceful little trees were gnarled and bare. The green had gone out of the meadows, and a faint smell of rot and mold rose up to the newcomers. The only colors left were those of swollen giant mushrooms, and of garish, poisonous-looking blooms that suggested nothing so much as the figments of a maddened brain. Enfeebled and trembling, the innermost heart of Phantastica was still resisting the inexorable encroachment of the nothing. But the ivory tower at the center still shimmered pure, immaculately white. Ordinarily, flying messengers landed on one of the lower terraces. But Falcor reasoned that since neither he nor Atreyu had the strength to climb the long, spiraling street leading to the top of the tower, and since time was of the essence, the regulations and rules of etiquette could reasonably be ignored. He therefore decided on an emergency landing. Swooping down over the ivory buttresses, bridges, and balustrades, he located, just in time, the uppermost end of the spiraling high street, which lay just outside the palace grounds. Plummeting to the roadway, he went into a skid, made several complete turns, and finally came to a stop, tail first. Atreyu, who had been clinging with both arms to Falcor's neck, sat up and looked around. He had expected some sort of reception, or at least a detachment of palace guards to challenge them. But far and wide there was no one to be seen. All the life seemed to have gone out of the gleaming white buildings round about. They've all fled, he thought. They've left the childlike empress alone. Or she's already...
Atreyu, Falcor whispered. You must give the gem back to her.
Falcor removed the golden chain from his neck. It fell to the ground. Atreyu jumped down off Falcor's back and fell. He had forgotten his wound. He reached for the glory and put the chain around his neck. Then, leaning on the dragon, he rose painfully to his feet.
Falcor, he said, where must I go?
But the luck dragon made no answer. He lay as though dead. The street ended in front of an enormous, intricately carved gate, which led through a high white wall. The gate was open. Atreyu hobbled through it and came to a broad, gleaming white stairway that seemed to end in the sky. It began to climb. Now and then he stopped to rest. Drops of his blood left a trail behind him. At length the stairway ended. Ahead of him lay a long gallery. He staggered ahead, clinging to the balustrade for support. Next he came to a courtyard that seemed to be full of waterfalls and fountains, but by then he couldn't be sure of what he was seeing. He struggled forward as in a dream. He came to a second, smaller gate. Then there was a long, narrow stairway
which took him to a garden where everything, trees, flowers and animals, was carved from ivory. Crawling on all fours, he crossed several arched bridges without railings, which led to a third gate, the smallest of all. He dragged himself through it on his belly, and slowly raising his eyes, saw a dome-shaped hall of gleaming white ivory, and on top of it, the Magnolia Pavilion. There was no path or stairway leading up to it. Atreyu buried his head in his hands. No one who reaches or has reached that pavilion can say how he got there. The last stretch of the way must come to him as a gift. Suddenly, Atreyu was in the doorway. He went in and found himself face to face with the golden-eyed commander of wishes. She was sitting, propped on many cushions, on a soft round couch at the center of the great round blossom. She was looking straight at him. She seemed infinitely frail and delicate. Atreyu could see how ill she was by the pallor of her face, which seemed almost transparent. Her almond-shaped eyes, the color of dark gold, were serene and untroubled. She smiled. Her small, slight body was wrapped in an ample silken gown, which gleamed so white that the magnolia petals seemed dark beside it. She looked like an indescribably beautiful little girl of no more than 10. But her long, smoothly combed hair, which hung down over her shoulders, was as white as snow. Bastian gave a start. Something incredible had happened. Thus far he had been able to visualize every incident of the never-ending story. Some of them, it couldn't be denied, were very strange, but they could somehow be explained. He had formed a clear picture of Atreyu riding on the luck dragon, of the labyrinth and the ivory tower. These pictures, however, existed only in his imagination. But when he came to the Magnolia Pavilion, he saw the face of the childlike empress, if only for a fraction of a second, for the space of a lightning flash. And not only in his thoughts, but with his eyes. It wasn't his imagination, of that Bastian was sure. He had even seen details that were not mentioned in the description, such as her eyebrows, two fine lines that might have been drawn with India ink, arching over her golden eyes, or her strangely elongated earlobes, or the way her head tilted on her slender neck. Bastian knew that he had never in all his life seen anything so beautiful as this face. And in that same moment, he knew her name. Moonchild. Yes, beyond a doubt, that was her name. And Moonchild had looked at him. At him. Bastian Balthazar Books. She had looked at him with an expression that he could not interpret. Had she too been taken by surprise? Had there been a plea in that look, or longing? Or what could it be? He tried to remember Moonchild's eyes, but was no longer able to. He was sure of only one thing, that her glance had passed through his eyes and down into his heart. He could still feel the burning trail it had left behind. That glance, he felt, was embedded in his heart, and there it glittered like a mysterious jewel. And in a strange and wonderful way, it hurt. Even if Bastian had wanted to, he couldn't have defended himself against this thing that had happened to him. However, he didn't want to. Oh no, not for anything in the world would he have parted with that jewel. All he wanted was to go on reading, to see Moonchild again, to be with her. It never occurred to him that he was getting into the most unusual and perhaps the most dangerous of adventures. But even if he had known this, he wouldn't have dreamed of shutting the book. With a trembling forefinger, he found his place and went on reading. The clock in the belfry struck 10.
11. The childlike Empress. Knitting his brow, powerless to utter a single word, Atreo stood gazing at the childlike Empress. He had no idea how to begin or what to do. He had often tried to imagine this moment. He had prepared words and phrases, but they had all gone out of his head. At length, she smiled at him. Her voice, when she spoke, was as soft as the voice of a bird singing in its sleep. "You have returned from the great quest, Atreyu." Atreyu hung his head. "Yes," he managed to say. After a short silence, she went on, "Your lovely cloak has turned grey. Your hair is grey, and your skin is like stone. But all that will be as it was, or better. You'll see." Atreyu felt as if a band had tightened around his throat. All he could do was nod his head. Then he heard the sweet, soft voice saying, "You have carried out your mission." Were these words meant as a question? Atreyu didn't know. He didn't dare to look up to read the answer in her face. Slowly, he reached for the golden amulet and removed the chain from his neck. Without raising his eyes, he held it out to the childlike Empress. He tried to kneel, as messengers did in the stories and songs he had heard at home, but his wounded leg refused to do his bidding. He fell at the childlike Empress's feet, and there he lay with his face to the floor. She bent forward, picked up Orin, and let the chain glide through her fingers.
"You have done well," she said, "and I am pleased with you."
"No," cried Atreyu, almost savagely. "It was all in vain. There's no hope." A long silence followed. Atreyu buried his face in the crook of his elbow, and his whole body trembled. How would she react? With a cry of despair, a moan, words of bitter reproach, or even anger? Atreyu couldn't have said what he expected. Certainly not what he heard.
Laughter. A soft, contented laugh.
Atreyu's thoughts were in a whirl. For a moment he thought she had gone mad. But that was not the laughter of madness. Then he heard her say,
"But you've brought him with you."
Atreyu looked up. "Who?"
"Our savior."
He looked into her eyes and found only serenity. She smiled again. "Golden-eyed Commander of Wishes," he stammered, now for the first time using the official word of address that Falcor had recommended.
No, really, I don't understand." "I can see that by the look on your face," she said. "But whether you understand or not, you've done it. And that's what counts, isn't it?"
Atreyu said nothing. He couldn't even think of a question to ask. He stood there, open-mouthed, staring at the childlike Empress.
"I saw him," she went on, "and he saw me."
"When?" Atreyu asked.
"Just as you came in. You brought him with you."
Involuntarily, Atreyu looked around.
"Then where is he? I don't see anyone but you and me." "Oh, the world is full of things you don't see. You can believe me. He isn't in our world yet, but our worlds have come close enough together for us to see each other. For a twinkling, the thin wall between us became transparent. He will be with us soon, and then he will call me by the new name that he alone can give me. Then I shall be well, and so will Fantastica."
As the childlike Empress was speaking, Atreyu raised himself with difficulty. He looked up to her as she lay on her bed of cushions. His voice was husky when he asked,
"Then you've known my message all along? What Maula the Aged One told me in the Swamps of Sadness? what the mysterious voice of Ulyulala in the Southern Oracle revealed to me? You knew it all?
Yes, she said. I knew it before I sent you on the great quest.
Atreyu gulped.
Why?
He finally managed to ask.
Why did you send me then? What did you expect me to do?
Exactly what you did, she replied.
What I did?
Atreyu repeated slowly. His forehead clouded over. In that case, he said angrily, it was all unnecessary. There was no need of sending me on the great quest. I've heard that your decisions are often mysterious. That may be. But after all I've been through, I hate to think that you were just having a joke at my expense.
The childlike Empress's eyes grew grave.
I was not having a joke at your expense, Atreyu, she said. I am well aware of what I owe you. All your sufferings were necessary. I sent you on the great quest, not for the sake of the message you would bring me, but because that was the only way of calling our Savior. He took part in everything you did, and he has come all that long way with you. You heard his cry of fear when you were talking with Igrimul beside the deep chasm, and you saw him when you stood facing the magic mirror gate. You entered into his image and took it with you, and he followed you, because he saw himself through your eyes. And now, too, he can hear every word we're saying. He knows we are talking about him. He knows we have set our hope in him and are expecting him. Perhaps he even understands that all the hardship you, Atreyu, took upon yourself was for his sake, and that all Fantastica is calling him.
Little by little, the darkness cleared from Atreyu's face. After a while, he asked,
How can you know all that? The cry by the deep chasm and the image in the magic mirror. Did you arrange it all in advance?
The childlike Empress picked up Orin and said, while putting the chain around her neck,
Didn't you wear the gem the whole time? Didn't you know that through it I was always with you?
Not always, said Atreyu. I lost it.
Yes. Then you were truly alone. Tell me what happened to you then.
Atreyu told her the story.
Now I know why you turned grey, said the childlike Empress. You were too close to the nothing.
Gmork the werewolf told me, said Atreyu, that when a Fantastican is swallowed up by the nothing, he becomes a lie.
Is that true?
Yes, it is true,
said the childlike Empress, and her golden eyes darkened.
All lies were once creatures of Fantastica. They are made of the same stuff, but they have lost their true nature and become unrecognizable.
But as you might expect from a half-and-half creature like Gmork, he told you only half the truth.
There are two ways of crossing the dividing line between Fantastica and the human world, a right one and a wrong one. When Fantasticans are cruelly dragged across it, that's the wrong way. When humans, children of man, come to our world of their own free will, that's the right way. Every human who has been here has learned something that could be learned only here, and returned to his own world a changed person. Because he had seen you creatures in your true form, he was able to see his own world and his fellow humans with new eyes. Where he had seen only dull, everyday reality, he now discovered wonders and mysteries. That is why humans were glad to come to Fantastica. And the more these visits enriched our world, the fewer lies there were in theirs, the better it became. Just as our two worlds can injure each other, they can also make each other whole again.
For a time, both were silent.
Then she went on,
"Humans are our hope. One of them must come and give me a new name. And he will come."
Atreyu made no answer.
"Do you understand now, Atreyu?" she asked. "Why I had to ask so much of you? Only a long story full of adventures, marvels, and dangers could bring our Savior to me. And that was your story."
Atreyu sat deep in thought. At length he nodded.
"Yes, golden-eyed commander of wishes, now I understand. I thank you for choosing me. Forgive my anger." "You had no way of knowing these things," she answered. "And that, too, was necessary."
Again Atreyu nodded. After a short silence, he said,
"But I'm very tired. You have done enough, Atreyu. Would you like to rest?" "Not yet. First, I would like to see the happy outcome of my story. If, as you say, I've carried out my mission, why isn't the Savior here yet? What's he waiting for?"
"Yes," said the childlike Empress softly. "What is he waiting for?"
Bastian felt his hands growing moist with excitement.
"I can't do it," he said. "I don't even know what I'm supposed to do. Maybe the name I've thought of isn't the right one." "May I ask you another question?" said Atreyu.
"Of course," she answered with a smile.
"Why do you need a new name to get well? Only the right name gives beings and things their reality," she said. "A wrong name makes everything unreal. That's what lies do. Maybe the Savior doesn't yet know the right name to give you."
"Oh, yes, he does," she assured him.
Again, they sat silent.
"I know it, all right," said Bastian. "I knew it the moment I laid eyes on her. But I don't know what I have to do."
Atreyu looked up.
"Maybe he wants to come and just doesn't know how to go about it.
All he has to do," said the childlike Empress, "is to call me by my new name, which he alone knows. Nothing more."
Bastian's heart pounded.
Should he try? What if he didn't succeed? What if he was wrong? What if they weren't talking about him, but about some entirely different Savior? How could he be sure they really meant him?
"Could it be," said Atreyu after a while, "that he doesn't know it's him and not somebody else we're talking about?"
"No,"
said the childlike Empress,
"not after all the signs he has had. He can't be that stupid."
"I'll give it a try," said Bastian.
But he couldn't get a word out of his mouth. What if it actually worked? Then he would somehow be transported to Fantastica. But how? Maybe he would have to go through some sort of change, and what would that be like? Would it hurt? Would he lose consciousness? And did he really want to go to Fantastica? He wanted to go to Atreyu and the childlike Empress, but he wasn't at all keen on all those monsters the place was swarming with.
"Maybe he hasn't got the courage," Atreyu suggested.
"Courage?" said the childlike Empress. "Does it take courage to say my name?"
"Then," said Atreyu, "I can think of only one thing that may be holding him back."
"And what would that be?"
After some hesitation, Atreyu blurted out,
"He just doesn't want to come here. He doesn't care about you or Fantastica. We don't mean a thing to him."
The childlike Empress stared wide-eyed at Atreyu.
"No, no!" Bastian cried out. "You mustn't think that. It's not that at all. Oh, please, please don't think that. Can you hear me? It's not like that, Atreyu."
"He promised me he would come,"
said the childlike Empress,
I saw it in his eyes.
Yes, that's true, and I will come soon. I just need time to think. It's not so simple.
Atreyu hung his head, and the two of them waited a long while in silence. But the Savior did not appear, and there wasn't the slightest sign to suggest that he was trying to attract their attention. Bastian was thinking of how it would be if he suddenly stood before them in all his fatness, with his bow legs and his pasty face. He could literally see the disappointment in the childlike Empress's face when she said to him, "What brings you here?" And Atreyu might even laugh. The thought brought a blush to Bastian's cheeks. Obviously they were expecting a prince, or at any rate some sort of hero. He couldn't just appear before them. It was out of the question. He would do anything for them. Anything but that. When, at last, the childlike Empress looked up, the expression of her face had changed. Atreyu was almost frightened at its grandeur and severity. He knew where he had once seen that expression. In the Sphinxes.
"There is one more thing I can do," she said. "But I don't like it, and I wish he wouldn't make me."
"What is that?"
Atreyu asked in a whisper.
"Whether he knows it or not, he is already part of the never-ending story. He can no longer back out of it. He made me a promise, and he has to keep it. But by myself, I can't make him."
"Who in all Fantastica," Atreyu asked, "can do what you cannot?"
"Only one person," he replied, "if he wants to. The Old Man of Wandering Mountain."
Atreyu looked at the childlike Empress in amazement.
"The Old Man of Wandering Mountain?" he repeated, stressing every word. "You mean he exists? Did you doubt it? The old folk in our tent camps tell the children about him when they're naughty. They say he writes everything down in a book, whatever you do or fail to do, and there it stays in the form of a beautiful or an ugly story. When I was little I believed it, but then I decided it was only an old wives' tale to frighten children."
"You can never tell about old wives' tales," she said with a smile.
"Then you know him?" Atreyu asked. "You've seen him?"
She shook her head.
"If I find him," she said, "it will be our first meeting."
"Our old folk also say," Atreyu went on, "that you never can know where the old man's mountain will be at any particular time. They say that when he appears, it's always unexpectedly, now here, now there, and that you can only run across him by accident, or because the meeting was fated."
"That's true," said the childlike Empress. "You can't look for the Old Man of Wandering Mountain. You can only find him."
"Does that go for you too?"
"Yes," she said, "for me too."
"But what if you don't find him?"
"If he exists, I'll find him," she said
with a mysterious smile. Her answer puzzled Atreyu. Hesitantly, he asked,
Is he like you?"
"He is like me," she replied, "because he is my opposite in every way."
Atreyu saw that with such questions he would get nothing out of her. And another thought weighed on him.
"You are deathly sick, golden-eyed commander of wishes," he said almost sternly. "You won't go far by yourself. All your servants and courtiers seem to have abandoned you. Falcor and I would be glad to take you wherever you wish, but frankly I don't know if Falcor has the strength. And my foot, well, you've seen that it won't carry me."
"Thank you, Atreyu," she said. "Thank you for your brave and loyal offer. But I'm not planning to take you with me. To find the Old Man of Wandering Mountain, one must be alone. And even now,
Balcor is not where you left him. He has been moved to a place where his wounds will be healed and his strength renewed. And you too, Atreo, will soon be in that same place.
Her fingers played with Orin.
What place is that? There's no need for you to know that now. You will be moved in your sleep. And one day, you will know where you were.
But how can I sleep? Cried Atreo, so shaken that he had lost his sense of tact. How can I sleep when I know you may die at any minute?
The childlike empress laughed softly. I'm not quite as forsaken as you think. I've already told you that there are some things you can't hope to understand. I have my 7 powers, which belong to me as your memory or courage or thoughts belong to you. They cannot be seen or heard, and yet they are with me at this moment. I shall leave 3 of them with you and Falcor to look after you, and I shall take the other 4 with me as my escort. You needn't worry, Atreo. You can sleep easy.
At these words, all the accumulated weariness of the great quest descended on Atreo like a dark veil. Yet it was not the leaden weariness of exhaustion, but a gentle longing for sleep. He still had many questions to ask the golden-eyed commander of wishes, but he felt that her last words had vanquished all his wishes but one, the wish for sleep. His eyes closed, and still in a sitting position, he glided into the darkness. The clock in the steeple struck 11. As though far in the distance, Atreo heard the childlike empress give an order in a soft voice. Then he felt powerful arms lifting him gently and carrying him away. For a long time, all was dark and warm around him. Much later, he half awoke when a soothing liquid touched his parched lips and ran down his throat. He had a vague impression that he was in a great cave with walls of gold. He saw the white luck dragon lying beside him, and then he saw, or thought he saw, a gushing fountain in the middle of the cave, encircled by 2 snakes, a light one and a dark one, which were biting each other's tail. But then an invisible hand brushed over his eyes. The feel of it was infinitely soothing, and again he fell into a deep and a dreamless sleep. At that moment, the childlike empress left the ivory tower. She lay bedded on soft silk cushions in a glass litter, which seemed to be moving under its own power, but it was actually being carried by 4 of the empress's invisible servants. They crossed the labyrinth garden, or rather what was left of it, making frequent detours, since many of the paths ended in the nothing. When at length they left the labyrinth, the invisible carriers stopped. They seemed to be waiting for a command. The childlike empress sat up on her cushions and cast a glance back at the ivory tower. Then sinking back, she said,
"Keep going. Just keep going, no matter where."
Blown by the wind, her snow-white hair trailed behind the glass litter like a flag. 12. The Old Man of Wandering Mountain. Long thundering avalanches descended from the heights. Snowstorms raged between towering ice-coated summits, dipped into hollows and ravines, and swept howling onward over the great white expanse of the glaciers. Such weather was not at all unusual for this part of the country, for the Mountain of Destiny, that was its name, was the highest in all Fantastica, and its peaks literally jutted into the heights of heaven. Not even the most intrepid mountain climbers ventured into these fields of everlasting ice. It had been so very, very long since anyone had succeeded in climbing this mountain that the feat had been forgotten. For one of Fantastica's many strange laws decreed that no one could climb the mountain of destiny until the last successful climber had been utterly forgotten. Thus, anyone who managed to climb it would always be the first. No living creature could survive in that icy waste, except for a handful of gigantic ice clumps, who could barely be called living creatures, for they moved so slowly that they needed years for a single step and whole centuries for a short walk. Which meant, of course, that they could only associate with their own kind, and knew nothing at all about the rest of Fantastica. They thought of themselves as the only living creatures in the universe. Consequently, they were puzzled to the point of consternation when they saw a tiny speck twining its way upward over perilous crags and razor-sharp ridges, then vanishing into deep chasms and crevasses, only to reappear higher up. That speck was the childlike Empress's glass litter, still carried by four of her invisible powers. It was barely visible, for the glass it was made of looked very much like ice, and the childlike Empress's white gown and white hair could hardly be distinguished from the snow round about. She had travelled many days and nights. The four powers had carried her through blinding rain and scorching sun, through darkness and moonlight, onward and onward, just as she had ordered, no matter where. She was prepared for a long journey and all manner of hardship, since she knew that the Old Man of Wandering Mountain could be everywhere or nowhere. Still, the four invisible powers were not guided entirely by chance in their choice of an itinerary. As often as not, the Nothing, which had already swallowed up whole regions, left only a single path open. Sometimes the possibilities narrowed down to a bridge, a tunnel, or a gateway, and sometimes they were forced to carry the litter with the deathly ill Empress over the waves of the sea. These carriers saw no difference between liquid and solid. Tireless and persevering, they had finally reached the frozen heights of the Mountain of Destiny. And they would go on climbing until the childlike Empress gave them another order. But she lay still on her cushions. Her eyes were closed, and she said nothing. The last word she had spoken were the "no matter where" she had said on leaving the ivory tower. The litter was moving through a deep ravine, so narrow that there was barely room for it to pass. The snow was several feet deep, but the invisible carriers did not sink in or even leave footprints. It was very dark at the bottom of this ravine, which admitted only a narrow strip of daylight. The path was on a steady incline, and the higher the litter climbed, the nearer the daylight seemed. And then suddenly the walls leveled off, opening up a view of a vast white expanse. This was the summit. For the Mountain of Destiny culminated not, like most other mountains, in a single peak, but in this high plateau, which was as large as a whole country. But then, surprisingly enough, a smaller, odd-looking mountain arose in the midst of the plateau. It was rather tall and narrow.